Okay, so we've talked about the ideas and what we do with statistical inference, including an example of a major decision that was made on the basis of statistics. Now I'd like to talk about what the process of doing statistical inference is about. So, inference is the practice of deducing hidden facts from observation. You see something and you want to know what it means. People do this all the time. For example, if you watch another person's face while they talk, you can infer their feelings about what you're saying or what they're saying by watching their face much of the time. But this kind of inference is risky. For example, my uncle always looks like he disagrees with something you just said. But that's false. You can't tell what my uncle is thinking by looking at his face because he had a stroke a few years ago and his face is mostly paralyzed. So his face no longer moves according to his feelings, even if he wanted to. Statistical inference combines the logic of probability theory with this idea of inference, of uncovering hidden facts. Here, we'll start by explaining classical or frequentist inference, which is implemented in most statistical software. Later, we'll discuss Bayesian inference, which has some strong advantages over classical inference, but it's not implemented in most statistical packages, so it's harder to use. You either have to do additional calculations yourself, or you have to use software that allows you to design your own procedures, such as R or Pandas in Python. So I want to cover both of them. Here's a simple example of statistical inference. If you roll a die 100 times and you count all the times each side comes up, and each side comes up just about equally often, you would conclude that the die is unbiased, that it's a fair die. Now, of course, the qualifier just about equally often is necessary here because the die has 6 sides and 6 doesn't go into 100 evenly. In fact, it goes in about 16.66 times. So it's not possible for all of the numbers to come up the same. And in fact, it's not that it's mostly going to be 17s and sometimes 16s. It's in fact going to be 15s and 14s and a few 18s. But that's close enough. So the problem of statistical inference is going to be figuring out what's close enough or not. Now, consider the opposite inference. Suppose we roll a die 100 times. If one side comes up too often, we would conclude that the die is biased towards that side. But these two cases can't be treated symmetrically. The problem is that when testing for bias, the hypothesis that the die is unbiased has an obvious quantitative specification that we can come up with without knowing anything about the situation. That is, that the probability that side 1 comes up is equal to the probability that the side 2 comes up is equal to the probability that side 3 comes up is equal to the probability that side 4 comes up equal to the probability that side 5 comes up equal to the probability that side 6 comes up. And all of them are equal to 1/6, obviously, under the laws of probability that says if you have the probability of everything that can happen, it has to add up to 1. We can use this hypothesis to compute the probability of any given deviation on the assumption that the die is fair. So, for example, the probability that the die comes up 100 times straight is 1/6 to the 100 power, which is a pretty small number. However, if the die is actually biased, the probability specification can't be given a priori. Any of the six faces might be the most likely under the bias, and the deviation from equal probability doesn't need to be very great for a person who knows the bias to make a lot of money gambling. So, when we calculate statistics, we have a null hypothesis and a alternative hypothesis. This is page 16. The null hypothesis is the one that we use for calculating probabilities. It's labeled H0, where the 0 is a subscript. The alternative hypothesis is often not very precisely specified. It's often specified as a range, the probability that, or the hypothesis that the probability of 3 is greater than 1/5. For example, 1/5 is bigger than 1/6, so that would mean that the die is biased towards. one towards coming up 3. In fact, typically the alternative hypothesis is something like not the null hypothesis. Our hypothesis is that it's biased, then our hypothesis is basically that at least one of the probabilities of sides 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 is not equal to 1/6. So that's a very big hypothesis in some sense. That's everything except the precise hypothesis of unbiasedness. And there are lots of alternative hypotheses that we could use, as we'll see in a moment. So the null hypothesis is usually specified very precisely, and it allows us to compute probabilities for any of the events that we might observe. If given the null hypothesis, the probability of the observed case is very high, we accept the null hypothesis and reject the alternative hypothesis, which is labeled H1 or sometimes HA. If it's low, we reject the null hypothesis and accept the alternative. We want to assign a decision to accept or reject H0 to every observation. You should be warned that there are some statistical tests, for example, the Durbin-Watson test for autocorrelation, which means that you have a variable that has a time series, and the errors in the past are correlated with the errors in the present, where this choice is very delicate and the standard procedure actually includes undecided cases. But normally we try to have an accept or reject for clarity of our decision. Also, if there are more than two possible observations, there will be many possible ways to assign an accept or reject. In the case of the loaded die, the obvious alternative hypothesis is that any of the faces is too frequent. But this is not well specified yet. There are three formulas that I give on page 17 for three different sets of outcomes, that is, events, where the F of N is the frequency of face N in the 100 rolls, and P bar is the number that is to indicate too often, typically greater than 1/6 or 16.66. So the first one is the case of any of them being too frequent. That is, the frequency of 1 is bigger than P bar, or the frequency of 2 is bigger than P bar, or the frequency of 3 is bigger than P bar, or the frequency of 4 is bigger than P bar, or the frequency of 5 is bigger than P bar, or the frequency of 6 is bigger than P bar. Now, we know because of the laws of probability that they can't all be true at the same time, but it's possible that more than one of them is true at the same time. And if we think about the physics of a die, it's probably true that one or two of them might be true, and then all of the other ones would be less than p bar, or less than 1/6. The second hypothesis is the standard least squares hypothesis. That is, that we have the probability that the deviation of f of I from 100 minus 100 divided by 6, which is the expected average under the unbiased hypothesis, the null hypothesis, we square that number of deviations, and we ask that that be bigger than some number d bar, and the probability of that be less than some number alpha. And if that probability is very low, but we still get bigger than, the standard deviation being bigger than d bar, then we would say that we're going to reject the null hypothesis. Finally, we have a case where we look at the absolute deviation. So we simply take the difference between the frequency and 100 over 6, and then we take the absolute value of that so that when we add it up, if there's a deviation, our sum gets bigger. And we look at some number d bar that that's bigger than, and if that's if the probability of that, according to the null hypothesis, is less than alpha, then we would reject. We might also want to consider that if one face is most frequent, the opposite face is generally going to be least frequent. Of course, you could load the die on two faces and probably arrange that those two are more frequent and all the others less. Finally, suppose that the owner of the die is observed consistently betting on 3. Perhaps then you want to check specifically if the die is loaded in her favor. That is, the probability that the frequency of 3 is bigger than the critical value is less than alpha, our significance level. So in the example above, we had a distance from equal frequency, an event that the observed frequency was farther than that from equal frequency, and the probability of that event. It turns out that the event and the distance are equivalent to each other. One is defined in terms of the other. The event is defined in terms of the distance. So as you will recall, events are generally thought of as sets of values, and the sets of values that we're interested in here are the number of outcomes of the roll that are each particular die. So this is the list of frequencies. And the list of frequencies then is our state. The event is the set of frequencies that are distant from the equal set of frequencies, that is 100 over 6. All of the ones that are farther than that are part of our event, and so the distance defines the event. They're equivalent to each other in this. The probability and the distance also define each other if we change our equation 4 to be an equality. The p bar is actually defined by the probability being equal to alpha. We call alpha the significance level of the test, and the parameter, which is p bar. In the original version, I wrote n bar. I'm going to correct that. The p bar is called the critical value, the number of rolls of that value that we count. Now, note that f of 3 is a random variable. The count is a random variable. it will vary depending on the experiment that we do. If we roll 100 times, the number of times 3 comes up is going to be different from the next time we roll 100 times. Well, sometimes they'll be equal, but mostly we would expect that sometimes it's 16, sometimes it's 17, sometimes it's 18. Very rarely is it going to be 20. So how do we pick this value alpha, our significance level of the test? We pick an alpha that's small enough that we are willing to bet against unbiasedness and use that to define the regions of resection and acceptance of the null hypothesis, H0. The region of rejection is also called the critical region. I say this is a bet because no matter how far from unbiased proportions the result is, so for example, 3 theoretically could come up 100 times. As I mentioned earlier, we can actually calculate the probability of this. It's 1/6 to the 100 power, which is a very small number, but it's bigger than 0. So we have to reject in this case. You'd be crazy if the die came up 3 100 times in a row to say that the die is unbiased, that the next time we roll 100 times, it's could be anything else. We'd have to bet that if we rolled it again, that it would come up 3 with that kind of evidence. But we could be wrong in terms of probability theory. When we talk about inference, then, we've already mentioned that we can make mistakes in inference. In statistical inference, because we have a model that's probabilistic that says that sometimes one thing happens and sometimes another thing happens, and we don't know why. That's the whole point of using probability. If we had a model of why things happen one time or another, then we would measure whatever the cause is, the why. So, for example, if we thought that for example, higher investment in one year results in higher GDP in the next year, then we can measure both the investment and the GDP in a series of years and compare the behavior of GDP from one year to the next against the investment in the preceding 2 years. If we think that, for example, women are more likely to buy makeup, we could get a sample of men and women and look at whether men buy makeup, how much makeup men buy, and how much makeup women buy. Now, depending on our sample, we might get some very strange men who all buy lots of makeup, and some somewhat less strange women, but still a little bit unusual, who never buy makeup. And we would come to the conclusion in that experiment, in that survey, that men buy more makeup than women do. This seems pretty unlikely based on the way things work in our modern society, but that is a possible outcome of survey research there. So we are always forced to consider the possibility of a mistake. Now, our statistical hypothesis test in the classical model generates this decision problem. Shall we accept or reject the null hypothesis? Usually the null hypothesis is a boring hypothesis. In the case of the die is fair. That might be exciting to the gambler, but the house doesn't like that very much. They would prefer a biased die that they can use to make money. In the case of a vaccine, the null hypothesis is that the vaccine has no effect. Obviously, we want the vaccine to have an effect. We want it to cure people, or more precisely, prevent disease. So we would like to know what the chances are that we'll make a mistake. And we can actually compute this based on our hypotheses. In the case of the null hypothesis being true, if we then get data that causes us to accept that hypothesis, there's no error. More mistakes here. If we reject the null hypothesis and it's true, then we have what is called a type 1 error. In the original table, I have that backwards. This is called a type 1 error, or a false negative. The hypothesis is true, but we rejected it, gave it a negative outcome. The other possibility is that H0 is false, and we accept it, in which case we have a type 2 error. Then, if we reject when it's false, of course that's the right thing to do, and we have no error. So we have two cases where there's no error. We have two different kinds of error. Why do we have two different kinds of error? Well, that's because the probability of each kind of error is different from the other one, at least in principle. You can construct tests occasionally where the probability of a type 1 error is equal to the probability of a type 2 error, but normally they're different from each other. The probability of a type 2 error, a type 1 error, is just the significance alpha that we used above. The probability of a type 2 error has a name, which is the power of the test. Unfortunately, it's not obvious how to calculate the power of a statistical test, because you need a specific parametric hypothesis, HA, to calculate probabilities of rejection when HA is true. But HA in a classical hypothesis test is a range of parameter values. That is, those values bigger than the critical value. So it's very difficult to come up with a persuasive calculation of the probability of type 2 error, the power, that works in all cases. Note that, for example, in this particular case with our dice, in order to calculate the power of the test, we would have to have our alternative in order to calculate probabilities, and our alternative would have to give us a probability for each die. In the case of the die that's loaded for the owner, with the face 3 coming up more probability than anything else, we still have 5 other faces to choose, and once we've said, okay, it's 1/5, which is too big. But we don't know that it's 1/5. It could be 2/11, which is a little bit bigger than 1/6, or it could be 1/4, which is way bigger than 1/6. So there's that controversy that we have to deal with. Then we also have to deal with the problem that we have 5 other faces to worry about. Now, it seems likely that if 3 comes up, the face on the opposite side, which is usually 4, is going to be the least likely, and we might suppose that all 4 other faces have equal probability. So we might say that the probability of this coming up is 1/5, and the probability of 4 coming up is, say, 2/5, and then we divide the remaining, 1/5, but 1/7, and we divide the remaining probability, which is, out of 35, Oops, that doesn't work, so I shouldn't do that in my head. Anyway, you could imagine coming up with a probability for the three side, a probability for the four side, which is less than 1/6, and then calculate the probabilities for the other four sides. So that is the problem that we face with calculating the power of the test. Now, the power of the test is really important. The significance of the test, if we make the significance very low, the probability that we accept the null, or the probability that we reject the null hypothesis and we're wrong, is very low. So we are protecting ourselves against making fools of ourselves by advocating the alternative hypothesis when it's not true. On the other hand, consider the vaccine case. We want the power of the test to be low as well. The reason for that is, suppose that we commit a type 2 error. What happens then? We've judged that the null hypothesis is true, that there is no effect. What does this mean? It means we don't use the vaccine. But if we're wrong about no effect and it actually had a good effect, then we've lost the chance to immunize people against some disease. But we'll never find out because we didn't use the vaccine. So a type 1 error can be a pretty big error. It doesn't risk the reputation so much of the researcher, because they don't ever really find out that they're wrong until much later when somebody does the research again, but that's unusual. People usually say, okay, well, we rejected the hypothesis, so that's not very interesting, and they go on and do something else where there's a chance of getting a spectacular result of rejecting the common sense or the default case. So we want power to be low, but it turns out that there's an inverse relationship between power and significance. If significance is low, so that the probability of type 2 error is, or type 1 error is low, then the probability of type 2 error tends to be high. So if we defend ourselves against the probability that we say something spectacular that turns out to be incorrect, which usually has a bad impact on your reputation, then we increase the probability that we don't find out something interesting. So power is very important, and the fact that the power of the test where the parents were asked after assignment and then we moved people from the testing group to the control group, the fact that the power of that was relatively high, the probability was high, meant that we were likely to miss out on a good vaccine, and that's a bad thing. We can get both error types down by having a bigger sample, but that gets very expensive.